and welcome back to another episode of Esquire Q&A, the show where we sit down with men and women who exhibit both style and substance. Now, previously we've talked to ace sportsmen, entrepreneurs, artists, musicians, filmmakers, and a lot more. But this will actually mark the first time, surprisingly for Esquire, that we've talked to a watchmaker. Max Busser is the man behind MB&F. The brand name actually stands for Max Busser and Friends. A legendary independent watchmaker that has been making waves in the usually calm world of Swiss watches for more than a decade. But don't take my word for it. Why don't we get straight to the podcast? Enjoy. So let's say, for example, you're at a party. No one knows who you are. How do you, what do you say? Who, hello, you are.
That's a tough one. I'm a watch creator, which sort of puzzles most people because they don't even know that's a job. I've been creating watches for 28 years. And 14 years ago, I created my own little company, which thinks that watches are not there to give time, which puzzles even more people. Like, what is this guy about? I think watchmaking is art. And therefore, I deconstruct traditional watchmaking and reconstruct it into 3D kinetic art pieces, which, oh, by the way, give you time. But that's not the point.
Yeah. So then, just even going into starting that company, I guess the whole kind of entrepreneur thing is already sexy now. Everyone wants to start their own kind of service or .com. But you started a watchmaking company. That's kind of above and beyond. How did you...
And in the country, which is completely entrepreneur adverse.
Yes.
I'm Swiss.
Yes.
Swiss people don't create their own companies.
Well, even the watch industry, there's a reason why kind of all the brands are 50, 100, 150, 250
clearly,
years old.
Clearly. The barriers to entry are enormous. And even more if you want to actually challenge what already exists. So I think it's much more of a life decision for me. There's no entrepreneur in my background, no artist in my background. I never expected to do that until one day when I was running Harry Winston and was very successful and realized that actually I hated my life. And that was in the middle of a therapy session. And so the therapist had asked me, like, if you walk out of a session now and get hit by a bus and you've got 2 minutes to live, what regrets would you have? And I was living the life. I mean, I had everything what men want, and I come from a family with no money, and I had suddenly money and my face in newspapers and all that. And I realized I was just so not proud of the man I'd become. And why was that? Because as a creator, and I've always been a creator, since I'm a little boy I've been creating, I'd sold out. I'd become a marketeer. So I'm sorry for all the marketeers who are listening to this. But for me, as a creator, you can't be creating thinking what people will like, because then you complete, it's a complete abnegation of yourself.
Yeah.
And I realized I have to create what I believe in. But what I believe in is so completely insane that basically I had to create a company to make it happen. And the other thing I realized during that session was that my parents were probably the most respectful and kind people I've ever met. And that the values they tried to pass on to me were trampled on a daily basis in my work, because you have to work with some horrible people. That's how it is. Professional life is accepted to work with terrible people. And I thought, well, maybe it's a bit of a wild dream, but maybe I could actually create a company where I only work with nice people. Of course, this is all a bit of a utopia, but we're getting there. Honestly, 14 years down the road, we're getting there.
Was there any kind of... Because obviously, you are married, you have children. I'm guessing, did you have children 14 years ago?
No, gosh, no. I created the company a couple of years after my divorce.
And we
didn't have children. So I knew there was that sort of window in my life. I was 38. And I thought, okay, if I meet somebody in the coming years and we decide to have a family, there is no way I'm going to take the responsibility of putting all my money in a wild venture and losing all of it.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
That was not possible. So I thought, do it now. I think all the stars aligned. I also think I was completely insane. When I look back at the risks I took, I honestly today, 14 years later, would not take those risks.
Did you always have kind of... Did you have a backup plan? Did you have one foot kind of outside just in case? Or was it everything in?
It was all in. It was all in. I put all my money in and I was ready to fail, which is really interesting because, don't get me wrong, I would have gone down kicking and battling to not fail, but it was okay in my mind somewhere that if I'd failed, I still would have tried. And that's what I also tell a lot of budding entrepreneurs come to see me and say, I want to create my brand or my company like you. And I ask them, why? Why do you want to? Mm. If they say it's because I hate my job, I'm like, well, you probably should stay at your job because being an entrepreneur is so tough and you've got so many chances of failing that you may regret then your job you don't like. But more importantly, don't do it for the money. Because if you do it for the money and you fail, then you're going to be so bitter the rest of your life. I did it because if I didn't do it, I would hate myself.
Yeah.
So even if I failed, I could look at myself in the mirror and say, you failed, but at least you tried.
I was having a discussion about this at lunch, and it was about entrepreneurship and how you've got to love the process. Because if you get into it just for the end goal, then you're never going to get there because you have to love the actual road, not the destination.
Definitely. And it's interesting also is like a lot of journalists ask me these days, so what are you going to do in 5 years or 10 years or whatever? And it's a legitimate question. And I have actually no idea, which always puzzles people. I'm like,
remove that
question. I have no idea what I'm going to be doing tomorrow. Mm. And the youngster I was needed certainties. To build myself, I built myself on, oh, this is what I expect. This is on my goals. This is how I'm going to get there. And in the last 10 years, the fact that I actually realized I have no idea what's going to happen. And that if you told me when I was 20 that I was going to work in the watch industry, I would have like, no way. When you told me when I was 30 and working at Jaeger LeCoultre that I was going to be next year the CEO of Harry Winston, I would have laughed you out of the room. And then when I was at the head of Harry Winston being successful, that I was going to throw all that away and create my own brand and nearly go bankrupt a couple of times, etc. I was like, no. And so you realize that some call it karma, but whatever happens, it's okay not to know. And once you accept that, you can be an entrepreneur.
So what about your kind of at the time, what about your kind of the your colleagues in the Swiss watch industry? Did you get any kind of any people giving you advice, telling you not to do it? Did you get any people going, absolutely, you need to do this?
I had a lot of people shaking their heads, but Swiss people are polite.
Yeah, they are.
So basically, I just saw in their eyes that they thought I was nuts, but oh, well, he probably can't be saved sort of thing. Mm. I'll always remember my mother. The day I told my mum, well, I'm going to quit Harry Winston. I'm going to create my company. And, well, she, like all mothers, she was always terrified for me.
Yeah.
And she told me one thing. She said, when you quit Jaeger LeCoultre to take over Harry Winston, your dad and I thought there was no way you're going to be able to pull that one off. Mm. And you actually proved us wrong. So I suppose you know what you're doing, or you think you know what you're doing, and I trust you're going to manage. But she still spend 13 years of being completely terrified for me. It's being an entrepreneur is not only a will, it's not only wanting to do something, it's having, of course, great ideas. I believe great integrity. That's what I believe in. It's the people who believe in you. I could never have done this if there were not dozens of people who believed in me. You can't do anything alone. And that's also the lesson you learn, is that you build that posse of people who believe in you over your years. Then you can say, guys, I'm going out on my own, and they'll maybe have your back.
Yeah.
It's not sure, but they're there to say, okay, if something happens, we may be there.
So then kind of from Harry Winston and kind of working at JLC, do you think if you'd worked for different companies, the watches you produced with MB&F would look different? I'm guessing have you taken inspiration from maybe even from a company, not necessarily a watch design point of view? Do you think that they would have come out looking slightly differently?
I think everything which happens to you in your life has an influence for the further part of your life. So that's very clear. Probably if I hadn't been in Harry Winston and I hadn't had the idea of creating the Opus, which was the first time where we actually collaborated with independent watchmakers and actually credited them for their work. And I met these guys who blew me away and gave me the idea that that was possible, then probably there wouldn't be an MB&F or it would be different. What I learned at Jaeger over the 7 years I did at Jaeger was actually how to work. Because when you come out of college, you have no idea. You're completely clueless. And I was very, very lucky to start in that company when it was more or less coming out of bankruptcy. So working with great integrity, great passion, in a time where the industry had no money and was basically trying to survive. Mm. And that's one of the many lucky things which happened to me in my life. Mm. Because I started at Jaeger when it was struggling. I arrived at Harry Winston when it was on the verge of bankruptcy. So all that made me see how it works to start from more or less scratch.
Yeah.
When you work in big conglomerates, which are very efficient with all the support systems, how are you then going to leave that?
Yeah, you take it for granted.
And create up your own company in your little sitting room. Mm. So I was very lucky to learn how to work in dire situations. Mm. So if I'd started in a very successful company, probably there wouldn't be MBNF. Mm.
So was there a moment when in MBNF where you went, oh, I think I may have just pulled this off?
Huh, that's a good one.
As in, like, when it stopped being a, okay, I'm going to start this out, cool, I'm going to produce the first timepiece, kind of, I've done that, I've got kind of the challenges. Was there a moment where, I don't know, if we were in a film, you would have won the Oscar, and then it would have been like, aha, he's done it.
I think there are a couple of tipping points. In 2010, we came out with a product called the Thunderbolt, which was the craziest product that I ever created in my life. And I remember telling my team 6 months before anybody saw it, guys, I don't think anybody's ever going to buy this. And we put every single cent and dime we'd made into that product. And everybody looked at me like, what do you mean? That watch, and I was right, the retailers barely ordered it. And then a few months later, we did the launch. And the launch with us was just me sending emails to a few journalists saying, hey, guys, this is my new product. And a miracle happened. And suddenly, phones started ringing and the emails started coming in. And the retailers were like, you know that weird product you showed me at Basel Fair? I actually have got a guy in the store who wants to buy it.
Yeah.
And it's been probably one of our best successes in sell-out, meaning in sell-through between selling to the retailer and getting out. And it was the craziest at that day. Mm. So that was a tipping point where I realized it's okay to be terrified and it's okay to go into completely uncomfortable territories.
Yeah,
I think there was another step, 2013. So we started in 2005. 2013, we hit the numbers I dreamt of. Mm. I think as an entrepreneur, it's really important to have a goal.
Yeah.
When I speak with, again, a lot of fledgling entrepreneurs, they don't want to give themselves a goal. They say, well, if it works, we'll grow. And if it doesn't work, we won't grow.
And okay.
You can't think that way. You know why? Because today we craft 220 watches a year. That's less than 20 a month. Mm. We do about 17 million Swiss francs, which in dirhams would be about 70 million dirhams.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where I wanted the company to be. Now, if I'd wanted the company to do 5,000 pieces and not 220, every single decision I took at the beginning of the company was wrong. Mm. It was the wrong, I should have sought for financing.
Yeah.
I should have created different products. I should have had a different team. I would have distributed differently. Everything I did would have been different if I had a different goal. So I had a goal and I hit that goal in 2013. And guess what? That's the year my first daughter was born. And that was some sort of a signal for me where I thought, okay, we're not going to grow anymore. Mm. And everybody's like, what do you mean you're not going to grow anymore? Like it might internally and externally, growth is the mantra. You can't not grow. I mean, how can you willingly not want to grow when people want to buy your product? Mm. I said, no, we're not going to grow. So for the last 6 years, we haven't made one dirham more every year. We're not producing more pieces. Mm. And therefore the sell-through, meaning that the sales at retailers or in our mad galleries, has been higher than our production for the last more or less 5 years. And so my retailers scream at me like, we need more product.
Yeah.
And I refuse. And of course, I can do that because I don't have any shareholders.
Yeah.
But that was another tipping point, when to have this freedom of saying, I don't care. I don't want to cry anymore.
Mm.
And that really frees you.
Yeah. So then I guess, would you describe... Because how many watches? You said 200, 220?
220, yeah.
So what about kind of some of the other products? For example, the music boxes.
Right.
So was that a... I mean, I'm guessing that doesn't count as the 220.
No.
Was that a purely because kind of I want to do it? Or was that a way that you were like, well, we could also... I mean, to be a cynical person, you'd go, aha, I'm not making more watches, but you've moved into a different product category.
Well, yes, but we don't make any money out of it. So it's not a business.
Yeah.
A lot of things, it's interesting. The other day I was talking with one of our best and smartest retail partners in the world. And I'd spent 3 days with him and we talked a lot about the company. And At some point he looks at me and he says, but you do so many wrong things. I'm like, what do you mean? He says, you spend 60% of your time working on projects where you either don't make any money or you lose money. Mm. Like the co-creations, meaning the clocks and the music boxes we create for others,
yeah.
Or the certified pre-owned chapter we've set up on our website, mm. Or even our mad galleries where I spend so much time curating for these artists where we don't make a nickel or a dime. And he's like, this is bad business. Mm. I said, you're probably right, but that's what makes us who we are. Mm. So coming back to these co-creations like the music boxes and the clocks, when I created the Mad Gallery, mm. The first one was created in 2011 in Geneva. Again, clueless to what we were doing. We had no idea what we were doing. At some point, like a few months later, I was jury at the Lausanne School of Design. And the youngsters who were having their diploma, well, some of them were so talented. Mm. And one of them came to me at the end of the session of his diploma and said, could I have an internship with you? And I thought, well, no, I design all my watches. My good old friend Eric Giroux is super talented and we're like twins. I can't bring somebody else in.
Yeah, you wouldn't have anything to do.
And so I was like, well, let me think about it. And there's one of the many things I've understood is when you see somebody talented, keep that person close. And so I called him up and I said, okay, but you're not going to design any watches. So he was very puzzled because like I'm going to MB&F and I'm not going to design any watches. I said, no, I've got other ideas. So he came and he did 8 months internship and we created the pen and we with Caron d'Ache, mm-hmm. We created the clocks, we created the first music boxes. And then I actually went to all these companies and said, these are the ideas we have. Would you be interested in doing them? Mm. And the business model is a bit weird because we basically have the ideas. They do the engineering and the production.
Yeah.
We do most of the sales for them and we do all the PR, but we only get like a 5% royalty on it. So at the end of the day, it's not at all a money-making operation. It helps them a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it helps me as a creator, it gives me new, new chapters to new streets to go down.
Yeah.
And so that makes me happy. And that's at the end of the day, what's most important. Actually, I'm digressing again, but I took on a coach this summer just to, at some point I realized maybe we have to do a workshop with our team and I need a coach for that. So the coach has lunch with me. At some point he says, so, what do you want to do with the company? And I think, and I say, well, I want to be happy. And he looks at me, says, who gives a damn about that? I'm like, well, no, that's the whole point. Me being happy today is not the same thing as me being happy 8 years ago, because now I've got a family and I want to have a much better balance in life than I had before. So it has a big influence and everything I want to do is just to be happy. I want to be free to create what I want to create. I want to be free financially. I don't want to have any shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. And he looked at me and he said, but that can't be the goal of the company. And he phrased it very well. He said, how am I going to go and see your 25 persons in your team and say the goal of the company is to make the boss happy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that, I understood that didn't work out. But I've built this company for 14 years on that mantra. What should I do so that I am proud and happy? And if it doesn't make money, that's not the point.
Yeah. But then kind of saying that, going back to kind of it helping kind of the brands you work with, a couple of years ago, I was in Switzerland with help with the Siddiqui's. Mm-hmm. And they took us to, Rouge. And they said, we're going to a music box where they make music boxes. And we all went, it was a load of press people from the Middle East. And we were just like, oh, who cares? They're like, it's actually where they produce all the MB&F stuff. And we went, oh, well, in that case, well, actually, we're really interested then. And then kind of going through, and everyone just went, well, does this go into this one? And they're like, no, that's something different. And it does actually help these brands quite a lot.
I think a certain amount of these brands have been have stuck to their conservative business models and their conservative products. Mm. Like a music box is there to give music. But we're in 2019. What I did is I created a music box which looked so cool that I wanted to have that on my desk. The added bonus is that actually if I press that button, there is this incredible melody.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not the point. Mm. It's the same story as my timepieces. Mm. The point is not to give time. Mm. It's to have this incredible sculpture on my wrist, which is incredibly made, but giving to time. And so And then they realized that. The same thing happened with the clockmaker, Lippe. I mean, they were doing these beautiful, conservative, classic clocks. Yeah. And nobody wants them anymore. Mm-hmm. And then we started creating robots and Deep Space Nine stations and octopussy and things like that. And suddenly, now I believe our creations are something like 70% of their business. And I'm so happy for them because it's brought a whole new dimension to what they were doing.
So then a lot of kind of, you don't mind saying, a lot of kind of the pieces that are designed, they play on your childhood.
Yep.
What is kind of the process of kind of translating that into something tangible?
So that's a good question, actually. Initially, 14 years ago when I started, I used to sketch a lot and let my mind wander. Mm. And when I hit a sketch which I actually liked, then I would try and go a little bit deeper and then realize where it came from. So often I would design a product and then realize it looks like a spaceship. Or then suddenly I would think, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have, I don't know, a clock which looks like a robot?
Yeah.
I'm a 52-year-old kid, so I allow myself that. We're not allowed that. We're not allowed. Grown-up men are not supposed to think that way. And so now I don't even sketch anymore. I just imagine things. And so suddenly I think, wouldn't it be cool to have a clock which looks like an octopus? And I start thinking, if the head would be like that, and the legs would be like that, and what would make it interesting? And then sometimes I look at my design and think, oh, that's naff. I don't want that, do I? And then just scrap it. And sometimes it actually becomes a real piece.
So then kind of one of the questions we have here is kind of, by basing everything on your childhood, are you ever going to run dry? But I guess if you now are just kind of imagining what you think is cool, then technically never.
We're in that phase now. Yeah. I think one of also the tipping points was the Aquapod HM7 watch we did, which was actually inspired by my wife getting stung by a jellyfish. So that was the first
timepiece. How does she feel about
it? She hates it when I talk about it. And so we were on a holiday in Ras Al Khaimah, and she goes running into the sea, and then I hear her screaming and running out of the sea, and it was full of jellyfish. And that episode sort of sparked, like, wouldn't it be cool to do a mechanical jellyfish on your wrist?
Yeah.
So that was the first, that was about, 4 years ago. It was the first piece which actually didn't stick in that scenario of my childhood memories. Mm-hmm. And from there on, you're seeing more and more of that happening. Mm.
So kind of use some of the terms we've been using. We've got watches, we've got kind of horological machines, we've got art. What do you think you produce? Do you produce watches? Kind of at its base level, do you think that you still produce watches that are art, or machines that happen to be watches, or?
I create mechanical sculptures.
Okay.
That's what I do. My canvas is watchmaking, meaning it's all, and you have to respect and worship where it comes from. So I adore vintage watchmaking, not 19th century. I'm sorry, not 20th century watchmaking, 19th century, 18th century watchmaking.
Where one man would make every single...
Exactly, when they were the pioneers, the great people of our industry who invented everything that we're doing today. And not only were they inventing it when often they didn't have electricity, it was so beautiful. Mm. They integrated beauty with functionality. Nobody asked them to do that, but that's the way they functioned. Mm. And it was art. And so for me, my canvas is that sort of thinking. I just create mechanical sculptures based on that.
Do you think that this company could have worked 30 years ago, 40 years ago? I just kind of think that, you know, we now live in a world where no one needs a watch.
Of course not.
Because we have technology.
Yeah.
Now, that just so happens that you make mechanical sculptures that look really good on people's wrists.
Yeah.
So do you think that means, which works amazingly well, they're kind of in tandem. I don't necessarily need to be able to go, I know the time, I can have something beautiful on my wrist. So do you think you could have, MBNF could have become a thing, maybe say 50 years ago?
I don't think it could have, for one single reason. Mm. We are here thanks to the internet. Mm. So without the internet, how was I going to get that message out there to the very few people who are as crazy as I am? Mm. Sometimes I feel like this lonesome dolphin in the ocean with its sonar. I send a message out with my sonar and there are hundreds of thousands of fish who just don't get it. And then from time to time, I'll get the sonar back from another dolphin going, oh, there is somebody out there who resonates on the same wavelength. Without the internet, I couldn't have done that. Mm. How was I going to do that? So internet, and now even, which is amazing, social media is also a very big, a very important part for us. Mm. Do we sell online? Do we sell through social media? Of course not. Mm. But it gets the message out there.
Mm. So then kind of there's, you worked for Harry Winston, you kind of said you kind of got to a point where you were very unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd sold out. Do you do anything purposely to ensure that doesn't happen now?
Huh.
And then do you ever foresee a time where you kind of you're sat in your office and you go, oh, now I need to scrap this. Now I need to go do something else.
Again, very good question. I abide by simple laws at MBNF. Everything I do has to make me proud. Whatever choice I make, it's always, in 10 years, will I be proud of doing this? I'll do it.
Mm.
Maybe I will not be very proud, but it'll be economically more viable. I will not do it.
Mm.
So that ensures that I think that the whole story continues.
Yeah.
But of course, I've got phases. And there are moments where I get bored.
Mm.
There are moments where I think, oh, I'm repeating myself. The whole story is about Groundhog Day. Like, it's all 1st of January starts all over again, and we're going to create all that and launch all that. So there I have to get out of my comfort zone.
Mm.
What ensures that I'm actually still super happy after 14 years is I keep on getting out of my comfort zone. I keep on taking creative risks. I'm a difficult person to work with for my team, because as soon as we get to a position where we're comfortable and that we feel that we're managing things, that we're finally in control, I'm going to rock the boat.
Okay, yeah.
Because I feel like it feels horrible for me when everything seems to be
smooth. You need a bit of drama.
I need drama. I need to take a risk.
Yeah.
You only get pride out of taking risks. If you go on holiday in the Maldives, you're going to enjoy it, but you're not going to be very proud of it.
Mm.
If you jump in a Norwegian fjord at 4 degrees, you're going to talk to your grandchildren about the fact that you did that. So you have to take risks to be able to be proud. So I keep on rocking the boat.
Mm. So then kind of how long does it take in a nutshell from conception to timepiece?
Unfortunately, between 3 to 4 years.
So here's kind of my question, because we're again from an Esquire point of view, we're all creatives,
mm-hmm.
and the beauty of what we do is obviously I work in digital. I get to test out cool things every day. On a magazine side, we get to test it out every month. You seem like the type of guy who has lots of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is that do you ever kind of go, well, that would be cool, and that would be cool? How do you kind of keep on one idea long enough as opposed to kind of jumping around and...
Now, you've hit the nail on probably my greatest frustration ever, is that whatever idea I'm going to have now coming out of the studio is going to take 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
And the man I will be in 3 to 4 years maybe will not like that idea when it finally comes out.
Yeah.
Which brings me to another situation I am in, is that every year we come out with a whole new product, a fully new launch.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm super proud the day or the week of the launch, because it's the end of 3 to 4 years of an incredible journey. But then on day 8, I'm like, so bored. I could just get this product out of my hands, because I'm interested in what you're going to see in 2023, 24, 25. Yeah. And to continue talking about what I created in 2014 is like, please give me a break. I don't want to do this anymore. But of course, there's a price to pay to your liberty. And we're a very small company, order financed. So yeah, of course, I go out there and I talk about what I do.
Mm.
I can't not do that.
Yeah. So then do you think that, would that ever change? Kind of with technology changing, you know, is there ways that you could actually shorten that kind of lead time? And then if you could, would you?
Well, if it's made, again, with the integrity, which is so important, and the artisanship is super important for us. If you look at contemporary art, 95% of the value of the art piece is often the idea. And there is the notion of craftsmanship that doesn't really enter how difficult it was to make. People don't look at that. For me, it's incredibly important that it's difficult to make. And it's that very few people can actually make it that way. And it's like stupid things. We're still probably one of the last companies in the world which hand engraves its movements. How pointless is that? I mean, we're already creating a pointless product, but here we actually hand engrave what everybody does it by machine and it looks great.
Yeah.
And I have still one gentleman on his binoculars with his little
tiny little chisel.
And by hand writing the engravings. And that makes me happy. So coming back to your question, of course, we're all dreaming of great 3D prints. Today you can do metal 3D prints, but the result is appalling. You don't have any tolerances. You can't, if you try and satin finish or polish it, there are bubbles in it, holes. Yeah. And so there is no way we'd accept something like that, even though probably functionally it would work.
Yeah.
But that is never going to enter one of my pieces. If one day 3D printing makes a product which is as good in metal as whatever we could actually machine, sure, I will go down and that will basically halve.
So it's not a case of just sticking to your guns out of pride. It really is if the product is better, we'll use it. But up until now, that doesn't exist.
Then there are open questions. For example, we've for the moment always refused to use silicon. A lot of watch brands have gone into silicon, hairsprings, other elements. It's a great material. It's not magnetic. So that means without going to the whole geek stuff, it's very important for the watch not to be magnetic.
Yeah.
But I'm not using it. I'm not using it for one simple reason, is that I lived through the 70s where we had digital watches.
Yeah.
Really cool LED watches. Well, if one of those watches, you find it today and it doesn't work, nobody can repair it.
Yeah.
And I have no idea if the way we... Because silicon is grown today. It's not machined. You've got a certain technology and you need a very advanced technology to make it. I have no idea that in 50 or 100 years, that technology will have become obsolete and nobody will be using it anymore.
Yeah.
So therefore, you can't reproduce the piece. While anything which I do, and as crazy as it looks, in 100 years down the road, a great mechanic and a great watchmaker will be able to repair it. Because any part can be remade with a lathe, a mill. I hope those will still be around.
Yeah.
Maybe they won't, but maybe I'm talking like an old
fool.
But that goes back to what
you said earlier about how you kind of respect kind of the real, real old school watchmaking. Because it's the same. You can repair those pieces.
You can repair. And that's one of the beauties of what we do.
So kind of what are some of your favorite pieces to come out of MB&F?
You mean to date of whatever we've done?
Well, if you want to tell me what's going to happen in the next couple of years, then by all means.
No, that I can't. But actually, as a creator, it's always the next piece.
Yeah.
So that's the one which gets my adrenaline hyped up. But in the pieces we've come out with, it's probably those which terrified me most. So we talked about the Thunderbolt HM4.
Yeah.
Then there was the HM6, the Space Pirate, the HM7 Aquapod, which was that mechanical jellyfish. I mean, think of a diving watch which looks like that. We were all completely... So we were looking at each other the day before the big trade show, SIHH, where we were going to present it, going like, again, who's going to buy this? And we put the price as low as we could because we were absolutely sure that nobody was going to buy it.
Yeah.
And everything we presented was like sold out in 2 weeks, which is... insane, actually. Yep. Recently, the Flying Tee, my very first venture into doing something for a woman. For 14 years, I'd been creating just for myself. It's my whole ego trip. And at some point in my life, I realized my whole life was... my whole family was my mother, my wife, and my daughter. My mum has now passed away, and I've got a second daughter. So I've had these three women around me for some time. And I thought, okay, stop being a... selfish bastard, basically, and try and do something for women. And that was appalling. It was horrible. I mean, it's like, not only had I completely lost any reflex as to how to create for somebody else, but guess what? For a woman. And if there's one thing we're sure of, is that us men don't understand women. And so I was like, what am I going to do? And I had complete writer's slash creator's block until one day I realized maybe if I just try and create one of my crazy mechanical sculptures which embodies whatever I love in the women of my life, then maybe that would work. Stop thinking what they would like. Because if you look at it, I created a lady's watch, which is 2 centimeters high. Now, everybody will tell you women want very slim pieces. Yep. It's a flying tourbillon, which is a very complicated movement. Everybody will tell you there's no market for complicated movements for women. And that was it. And plus all the different things we did around it. And we crafted 35 pieces this year, and they're 27 have already out of the stores. And my retailers want more. Again, I only did 35.
Yeah.
That's also one of the reasons I want the company to stay small, is that if I start growing, I probably won't have the luxury of being completely wacky in what I do, because I'll need to sell more. And therefore, instead of doing 35, I'll create a product and saying, oh, I have to do 350.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There is no way there are 350 clients out there from the crazy pieces I do.
Although you say that, I mean, MB&F is very, very well known.
By very, very few people.
Well, fair. Well, in the watch industry, especially. But who do you think, talking about those clients, who buys one of your pieces? What sort of person?
That's super interesting, because I've discovered over the journey, I had no idea initially who would be and actually capable of doing this. What I've noticed is that, first of all over the world, it's the same client.
Okay.
Which is amazing. Meaning, it could be a client from Taipei, from Singapore, from Dubai, from Paris, from Los Angeles. They don't have the same culture, the same upbringing, the same religion, the same race, whatever you want to call it, but they're the same people. Mm. They're usually very strong-minded individuals who don't care what other people think of them. Mm. Because we're not a status piece of watchmaking. We're not something that people will wear going, look how rich I am or how successful I am, because nobody knows what they're wearing.
Yeah.
So people who will actually have the courage to buy an MB&F don't care about that. They don't care that most not only don't know what it is, don't understand it, but actually that people will judge them going, are you dumb? Why didn't you buy a Richard Mille? Why didn't you buy a Patek Philippe?
Yeah.
That's a sure bet. Why did you go and buy that thing that nobody's ever heard of? Mm. And they're very proud of that.
Mm.
So very, very self-assured individuals who don't want to show off and who appreciate as much watchmaking. They know what they're talking about as the reason why this product exists.
Mm.
Meaning, the reason, the story behind what we've tried to do all these years is as important as the product itself. And so I think there's a romantic perspective to our clients.
Mm. So are there any kind of are there any kind of watch brands today that kind of you admire?
Of course. Mostly,
those things that excite you?
Those who resonate with me are those whose story is a bit like mine. It's the entrepreneurial story. It's the passion story. It can be as classic a piece as a Kari Voutilainen. Kari crafts about 35 to 40 watches a year.
Yeah.
It's superb finishing, beautiful pieces, very classic. So when I say that, most people look at me weird, like, that's so classic. But I love classic watchmaking.
Mm.
And then you've got an Uhrwerk, which is something completely in a different paradigm, which is super modernistic, which they've been for 20 years basically writing their story, improving on it with this three-dimensional time reading.
Mm.
A young creator like Benoît Mintiens, who's got the brand called Resence.
Yeah.
Again, there's an incredible story. Benoît was an industrial designer in Antwerp, and he had an idea of a watch, and he had it made in Switzerland, and actually built his company for the first 5 years while he kept his day job in Antwerp. Now he's got a family and kids, and so on weekends, in the evenings, and on holidays, he would be in Switzerland taking care of his company while he had a day job. And it's only after 5 years that he afforded himself to actually drop his day job. And integrate 100% his company. And not only is that something I admire, but what he designs, his ideas are amazing.
Yeah.
It's a breath of fresh air in a very conservative market.
Mm. Perfect. Well, we could go on for absolutely ages, but we're not, because I know you're a busy guy. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And what we're going to do is we'll link kind of all the different models we talked about will be linked into it so people listening can follow along.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Because your pieces do need to be seen to be
definitely
believed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that has been another episode of Esquire Q&A. Now, if you want to know more about Max, MBNF, or just to see some of his amazing watches, then be sure to hit up esquireme.com, where we feature just about every one of his amazing creations. Other than that, be sure to make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, as well as leave a review on your favorite iTunes app store. Other than that, be sure to make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back with another Esquire Q&A next week.